8, 6, 1, 0.
Welcome to the Radio Art Hour, a show where art is not just on the radio, but is the radio.
Oh, radio, radio. Uh-huh. Oh, radio, radio.
The Radio Art Hour draws from the Wavefarm Broadcast Radio Art Archive, an online resource that aims to identify, coalesce, and celebrate historical and contemporary international radio artworks made by artists around the world. Created specifically for terrestrial AM/FM broadcast, whether it be by commercial, public, community, or independent transmission. Come on a journey with us as radio artists explore broadcast radio space through poetic resuscitations and playful celebrations, subversions of the complex relationship between senders and receivers in this hour of radio about radio. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the Radio Art Hour and Wavefarm's Radio Art Archives.
In its 10 years as a weekly national series from 1987 to 1998, New American Radio commissioned and distributed over 300 original works, conceptual new drama, associational documentary, language explorations, sonic meditations, environmental compositions, musical explorations, and works that pioneer new dimensions in acoustic space. Wavefarm is thrilled to partner with New American Radio to ensure these works remain available to listeners today and into the future. New American Radio was organized by Helen Thorington, executive producer, and Regina Beyer, associate producer. A special thanks to both Helen Thorington and Joanne Green for their generous support and collaboration in this partnership. Up next is Auto Dream Mode Graphical Tales by Terry Riley. Thank you for listening.
While storing some of my sound samples in a deep underwater chamber so they can be retrieved later, I encounter a dwarf with dark skin and ever-changing facial features. I have to ask him his name several times, but finally come to understand his name is Ping. He is interested in something I have, or wants to teach me of something he has, I'm not sure. I seem to be left with some word fragments, which there are more that I can't remember. Ovat, Otep, Ovat, Otep. I have been flying over a beach effortlessly, with many people stopping to look up. At times, I dip too low and I'm almost caught by the feet. This gives me anxiety. While back in the barn, I encounter Ping again. Face like a dog with enormous jaws that are snapping at some object that I have in my hand. I climb a lattice up into the loft. Friends are flying out the windows, but suddenly I'm too weak to fly. I gaze out the window, considering to leap through it in flight, but decide against it and slowly descend the lattice, taking care not to fall. I'm on a long bus ride, a large modern bus with first class seats, lots of room for everybody. Some of the passengers seem to be band members of mine, but I don't know them. Occasionally, the bus stops and someone gets off. We finally arrive at the venue. There are two pianos and boxes of electronic equipment that we have to set up. Someone has prepared food and water and a large table. They are very hospitable and haven't had many artists or musicians in these parts. All the electronic equipment has to be set up to connect the two pianos. I'm trying to remember the delay times as the machines are not programmed. At first, I think it's 400 milliseconds. And then I see 380 milliseconds, and I know that that's right for one. And the other machine has to be programmed for 190 milliseconds. I remarked to George that we need at least 4 hours to set up. But the small audience is already there. We tell them to come back later and continue working. The concert never takes place. In Italy, I experience a miracle. I'm walking through the grounds of an old church, which has filigreed arches that sprawl in many directions. They shine golden and red in the sun, and their elaborate ornamentation is very pleasing to the eye. We come out onto the edge of the lake where many people are gathered. There is to be a miraculous apparition by a saint that day. I stare out across the lake, straining to catch a glimpse of this miracle. Slowly, the sun shining behind the clouds forms an outline of a man. Even though it is vague, I become overcome with emotion and exclaimed to the crowd, "I see him! I see Santa!" Then, suddenly, instead of a vague outline, it becomes a clear, shining, radiant form of the same, gently rolling in the sky. The form is only the head and torso from the waist up. I run to tell Anne that I have seen the saint. I have seen the miracle. I am overcome with emotion. I'm now back in London, England, and marvel at how all the blocks are square like in New York. I'm also happy I don't have jet lag, even though I've just arrived. I attend an orchestral rehearsal where one orchestra is playing a piece I don't remember writing, although I find it quite attractive and agreeable. The conductor is a Maurice Chevalier lookalike, and he is tall and dressed elegantly. He conducts with economic but passionate gestures. He is coaxing marvelous sounds out of the orchestra. They interrupt the rehearsal momentarily, and players in the orchestra begin to give testimony to how wonderful my music is. One woman says, "Zucchini," which was apparently the name of my piece, "has everything I ever knew about music in it, and more." Other young composers in the orchestra, who seem to be Mexican, apologize for having failed to mention how much I have influenced them. Then the conductor gives a long and terribly profound talk about the meaning of this music and how it should be played. I'm very moved by his eloquence. It seems no one has ever said such deep things about music. I feel a great urge to document what he is saying. I tell him I'm bringing a film crew from the States to capture his marvelous conducting and profound thoughts. He then resumes the rehearsal of Zucchini, and his conducting is even more incredible than before. The music touches great magic and emotional depth. The music ends. He takes off his top hat, and in a gesture of grace and elegance, it rolls over several times along his arm before being caught in his waiting fingertips. At the same moment, he strolls off the stage and into the darkness. I am rehearsing a piece of mine with a black woman, a piece that requires singing dyads in thirds with only one voice. She sings first, and then she asks me to demonstrate the same passage. There are many other musicians present. Criticizes me, saying I'm holding my head to one side while singing and look stiff and unexpressive. She tells me that I must learn to move my head while singing, swaying with the music. I respond that I feel stiff and that it would be artificial to do so, and it would look and feel dumb. Later on, I am following a black man who is a musician. Down the aisle of a theater. And I am telling him. It's important to stay loose. The hangman's noose. I know who drew him. It was Dr. Seuss. The steady hand, the clever rhyme. The picture's faded now. The drummer's out of time. I am playing an exotic double reed instrument, quite beautifully, on the street of some unfamiliar city. I marvel at how easily I play this instrument, even though I've never played it before. People passing by are deeply affected by its entrancing sound. Suddenly, an old Indian fakir, a renunciate, who's quite well known to me, he appears. He's walking by very fast, and I'm happy and surprised to see him in this unexpected place. Even though I've known him well for many years, he barely acknowledges me and continues walking on rapidly. I ask, how have you been? He doesn't answer. I notice that instead of his old baggy sweatshirt and baggy pants and floppy cap and long white hair and beard, he's very dapper and clean-shaven, except for a tiny pencil-lined mustache. He's wearing a freshly pressed white shirt, a tie, an elegant pullover sweater, and a gray felt fedora. He goes into a grocery store, and I follow him. It is very crowded inside. Suddenly, I'm aware that I'm smoking a cigarette. Fakir is standing on the other side of the store, and he's also smoking. Around me are huge clouds of smoke, and I become aware that people are giving me very mean stares, as it's not permitted to smoke inside. No one is paying attention to the fakir, as his cigarette is barely lit, while mine is a veritable bonfire, and I'm unable to put it out. The fakir purchases what he came in for, and as we are leaving, he gets into my shopping cart and sits like a baby. Only now, his appearance has been transformed, and he is in his old gray sweatshirt and pants and saggy cap. He has a full head of long white hair and a long white beard. I'm leaving the store pushing the shopping cart with the old fakir in it when I look up and notice that the previous young dapper fakir is walking just ahead of us. Again, very fast, with a spry and agile step. We pass through a park, me pushing the old fakir in the shopping cart while the young dapper fakir is leading the way. I see Nataraj in the park, and he gives a big and knowing smile, as if in witness to the miraculous appearance of the simultaneous versions of the fakir. As we walk on, I turn to Nataraj and give a clenched fist salute. He salutes back and follows us. At that moment, the image of the young dapper fakir begins to gradually fade out while he's walking ahead. And I take this to be a sign that he is dying and say so to Nataraj. The old fakir still remains the same in my shopping cart. Meanwhile, the young dapper fakir begins writhing on the ground in convulsions, and his image is transforming slowly into the old fakir. At first, I am resigned that he is dying and am helpless to intervene. But then, I feel compelled to help him, and I embrace him and tell him I am there, that he's not alone, that everything will be okay. Nataraj is also holding him. And then, miraculously, he recovers. We experience an instant scene change and are in some kind of bar, and the young dapper fakir is drinking a Bloody Mary snow cone. He tells Nataraj and I that he now wants one without ice. Nataraj asks, "Shall I go get one?" The young fakir, who has never driven, replies, "No, I can't drink. I'm driving. I have to find my car." At that moment, an elderly Indian couple enter the bar, which by now is transformed into a store that sells saris. She asks to be shown some clothes, and the fakir pretends to be the clerk and tells her to sit down. He stands behind her and begins fondling her breasts and prodding her body, all the while making comments. "Oh, you have to tighten up here. Oh, this is sagging. Oh, this is out of shape." She seems to enjoy this. Then, quite incredibly, turns her upside down to reveal her bare bottom, which is disgustingly fat and grotesque. Now I understand that the way of the fakir is mysterious, but nonetheless, turn away, horrified.
From my place in the darkest night, I see them veil in the pale moonlight. From here, it's just down the street where I see two shadows meet.
You just heard Auto Dream Mode Graphical Tales by Terry Riley, broadcast by New American Radio.
Welcome to New American Radio, a series exploring new territories for the art of radio.
Up next is The Long Suffering of Anna Magdalena Bach by John Rose.
Thank you. Between 1723 and 1742, I gave birth 13 times, praise God. Nothing unusual about that. Just a question of pushing the reset button on how's your father. 1723, Christiana Sophia Henrietta was born. Praise God, push the button. In 1724, Gottfried Heinrich was born. Praise God. 1725, Christian Gottlieb was born. Praise G, I'll push the B. 1726, Elizabeth Eliana Frederica was born. 1726, Christiana Sophia Henrietta was buried. Praise G, B. 1727, birth of Amnustus Andreas. 1727, death of Amnustus. Praise God, reset. 1728, funeral of Christian Gottlieb. 1728, Regina Johanna was born. 1729, short pause. 1730, birth of Christiana Benedicta. 1730, funeral of Christiana Benedicta. 1731, Christiana Dante was born. 1732, birth of Johann Christoph Friedrich. 1732, death of Christiana Dorothea. 1733, out goes Regina Johanna. 1733 again, in comes Johann August Abraham. And later in 1733, out he goes again. Yep, curtains for Johann August Abraham. 1735, birth of Johann Christian. 1737, birth of Johanna Carolina. 1739, as you can hear, things slowing down a bit, death of my adopted son, Johann Bernard, in 1715 in Weimar. 1742, birth of Regia Susanna. And not forgetting the ever-present offspring of Maria Barbara, that's the first Mrs. JSB. There's Wilhelm Friedemann, we call him Silly Willy because he's gone quite mad, and Carl Emanuel, who's another impossible number cruncher. We call him CPE for short. I blame the father. Hi, I'm Anna Magdalena, born 1701. I'm a singer. You just heard me. Nice stuff, eh? But in 1721, I got married to the Kapellmeister, Johann Sebastian Bach. So, that was that. Like the end of my singing career. Full stop. But I also play keyboards. In our house, there are heaps and heaps of different types. Some are quite the latest thing. My husband's a bit of a collector, you know. Normally, I just play for myself, but well, I'm willing to play for you on this occasion. If you like. This is one of our cembalos, a period instrument. So do I ever see the old man, I hear you ask? After all, he's so busy training the choir and the orchestra, and yes, a new cantata must be written every week. Of course, he cheats now and then and uses stuff from a few years back. Well, no one ever notices, though. The city fathers are all tone deaf, she thought. Plus, he's such a cantankerous beast sometimes. Oh, I remember well the duel with the first trombone player a few years ago. They used to put time to the education of Silly Willy, CPE and Joe Jr., but those days are now long gone. It's not every night. Sometimes he just pounds away at the He says it's a genetic problem, all that pounding, pounding, pounding. Can't stop it, he says. It's God's will. Nonsense, husband, says I. It's the random generator. We be without them. But as my mother always told me, if you want fresh jeans in the morning, get them yourself. No good expecting other people to take care of the future. Come on, old girl, in the bucket. But then again, I guess you can have too much of a good thing. She considered. Too many serious genes can get you in all kinds of trouble. It's making JSB go blind. And after the blindness... Oh, we will be calling for Dr. Seltzer again, I expect. How'd you like the music so far? I know. You're a fan of my husband's. Thought you knew the whole opus, eh? But hadn't come across this. Well, of course you didn't, dummy. That's because I wrote it. Yeah, it's true. I give the old man quite a few tips from time to time. Time, you ask? Where do I find the time? I know what you're thinking. She can't be out of her 30s yet, but she looks way past it. Well, let me tell you, so would you if you've been cranking out little geniuses every other year. Not so much little barks, more like a bloody great river. Anyway, I'm still here to tell it. I'm like poor old Maria Barbara at the first Mrs. JSB. Pound, pound, crank, crank. But in 1,000 years from now, almost everyone will be related to old Johann Sebastian and me. How about that? She wondered. Think of it. Each and every one of them containing a few genes of your actual JSB-type genius. Even those completely tone-deaf.
Thank you.
just too many Joes in this family. Johann this, Johanna that. It's the old man, of course, who is responsible for the names. I never get a word in on the subject. I must say, I think, she thought, he could show more imagination on this. I tell him he's immortalised himself enough already, but it doesn't seem to register in his brain. Husband, I say. The universe doesn't give a monkeys anyway. Give up on the why, just enjoy the how. She realised. He was at me again last night, pounding away, pounding away. Das bügelnde Klavier, the ironing keyboard. This is a 1741 clavichord, hot off the shelf. You know, the dream of every note of music is to become two notes, and the dream of every two notes is to multiply and become four, and four to become eight and so on, the end of time. This is secundum naturam, according to nature. And there is nothing weird, contra naturam, against the laws of nature, about that. Ask Dr. Seltzer, our undertaker. He'll go for the beast, praeter naturam, any time of a miracle, super duper naturam. Makes for more interesting music. And besides, keeps him in work too. As he says, the solution to the problem of life will be seen when the problem disappears. Get your head around that one, eh? time to get the sauerkraut out of the washing machine. One thing about being the Kapellmeister's wife is that we can at least afford the latest digital appliances. We've got the numbers, you see. I've gathered round a few family members and relations for the next variation. The old man himself has even condescended to play the Grossa Violine from Bologna. I have to say, now, that's a real beast to play. We used to do this kind of thing a lot in the old days, before Silly Willy went mad and CPU got famous. Nowadays, all the kids just sit like stuffed dummies in front of their PCs. She laughed. Yes, I hear you. Whatever happened to family purpose, you say? Ah, here comes the old grouch. We'd better get on with it. So, is the universe such a bleak place?
Yes.
Okay, ready? And... Dr. Seltzman again. Somebody must have died. Well, I counted all the family just before dinner. They all seemed to be there. Must have missed one, she planned. Yes, hi, Dr. Seltzman. Oh, please carry on. You've come for the old man. Oh, upstairs, first room on the left. Don't mention it.
Thank you.
Gale, son of Johann Ernst, or Barks, the lover, Wilhelm Hieronymus, in the seat of Johann Christoph, Johann Lorenz, Johann Elias, Johann Valentin, all great talents, so they say.
You just heard The Long Suffering of Anna Magdalena Bach by John Rose, broadcast by New American Radio.
A6089.
That was the Radio Art Hour, mostly put together from the work of Wave Farm Radio Art Fellows Jess Speer and Karen Werner. Go to wavefarm.org for more information about the radio art you heard featured on the Radio Art Hour. The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.